both letters and made a telephone call. Now he really had good news to deliver. Raymond felt the DC-9 thump down in Pittsburgh after a brief flight that had allowed him to sit alone and think through several options. His colleague, brother, in Baghdad, had been a little too sacrificial in his attitude, a little too dramatic, and the detail around the Iraqi leader had been pretty large, actually larger than the one on which he himself served. How to do it? The trick was to create as much confusion as possible. Perhaps when Ryan walked into the crowd to press the flesh. Take the shot, kill one or two of the other agents, then race into the crowd. If he could make it past the first line or two of spectators, all he had to do was hold up his Secret Service ID. Better than a gun for getting through things. Everyone would think that he was chasing the subject. The key to escaping from an assassination, the USSS had taught him this, was in the first 30 seconds. Survive that, and you have a better-than-even chance of surviving it all. And he would be the one setting all the security arrangements for the Friday trip. How, then, could he get the President to a spot in which he would have that option? Take POTUS. Take Price. Take one other. Then melt into the crowd. Probably better to fire from the hip. Best if the citizens didn't see the gun in his hand until after the shots. Yes, that might work, he thought, taking off the lap belt and standing. There would be a local treasury agent at the end of the jetway. They'd go right to the hotel whose large dining room would host President Ryan's speech. Raymond would have all day and part of tomorrow to think it through, under the very eyes of fellow agents. How challenging. Major General John Pickett, it turned out, was a graduate of Yale Medical School, added to which were a pair of doctorates, molecular biology from Harvard and public health from UCLA. He was a pale, spare man who looked small in his uniform. He hadn't had time to change and was wearing camouflage BDUs, making his parachutist's wings look very out of place. Two colonels came with him, followed by Director Murray of the FBI, who'd raced over from the Hoover Building. The three officers came to attention as they walked in, but now the Oval Office was too small, and the President led them across the hall into the Roosevelt Room. On the way, a Secret Service agent handed the General a fax that was still warm from the machine in the Secretary's room. "Case count is now 137, according to Atlanta," Pickett said. 15 cities, 15 states, coast to coast." "Hi, John," Alexander said, taking his hand. "I've seen three of them myself."
"Alex, glad to see you, buddy." He looked up. "I guess Alex has briefed everybody in on the baseline stuff?"
"Correct," Ryan said.
"Do you have any immediate questions, Mr. President?"
"You're certain that this is a deliberate act?"
"Bombs do not go off by accident." Pickett unfolded a map. A number of cities were marked with red dots. One of his attending colonels placed three more down: San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas.
"Convention cities. Just how I would have done it," Alexander breathed. "Looks like Bio-War 95, John."
"Close. That's a war game we played with the Defense Nuclear Agency. We used anthrax for that one. Alex here was one of our best for planning offensive bio," Pickett told his audience. "He was red team commander for this."
"Isn't that against the law?" Kathy said, her face outraged at the revelation.
"Offense and defense are two sides of the same coin, Dr. Ryan," Pickett replied, defending his former subordinate. "We have to think like the bad guys do if we're going to stop them."
"Operational concept?" the President asked.
He understood that better than his wife did. "Biological warfare at the strategic level means starting a chain reaction within your target population. You try to infect as many people as possible, and that's not very many. We're not talking nuclear weapons here. The idea is for the people, the victims, to spread it for you. That's the elegance of bio-warfare. Your victims actually do most of the killing. Any epidemic starts low and ramps up, slowly at first, like a tangential curve, and then it rockets up geometrically. So if you're using bio in the offensive role, you try to jump-start it by infecting as large a number of people as you can, and you opt for people who travel. Las Vegas is the tip-off. It's a convention city, and sure enough, they just had a big one. The conventioneers get infected, get on the airplanes to fly home, and they spread it for you.
Any chance of discovering how they did it? Murray asked.
He showed his ID so that the general would know who he was.
Probably a waste of time. The other nice thing about bioweapons is, well, in this case, the incubation period is a minimum of 3 days. Whatever distribution system was used has been picked up, bagged, and trucked off to a landfill. No physical evidence. No proof of who did it to us.
Save that for later, General.
What do we do? I see a lot of states with no infection.
That's just for now, Mr. President. There's a 3 to 10 day lead time on Ebola. We don't know how far it's gotten already. The only way we can find out is by waiting.
But we have to initiate curtain call, John, Alexander said, and we have to do it fast.
Mahmoud Haji was reading. He had an office adjoining his bedroom and actually preferred working here because of the familiar surroundings. He did not enjoy being disturbed here, however, and so his security people were surprised at his response to a telephone call. 20 minutes later, they let the visitor in without an escort.
"Has it begun?"
"It has begun."
Badrine handed over the CDC printout. "We will know more tomorrow."
"You have served well," Dariai told him, dismissing him.
When the door was closed, he made a telephone call. Alahad didn't know how circuitous the link to him was, merely that it was an overseas call. He suspected London, but he didn't know and wouldn't ask. The inquiry was entirely routine, except for the time of day. It was evening in England, after business hours. The variety of the rug and the price were the key parts, telling him what he needed to know, in a code long since memorized and never written down. In knowing little, he could reveal little. That part of the tradecraft he did fully understand. His own part came next. Placing the back-in-a-few-minutes sign in his window, he walked out, locked the door, and went around the corner, proceeding 2 blocks to a payphone. There he made a call to pass on his last order to Araf Rehman. The meetings had started in the Oval Office, were transferred to the Roosevelt Room, and were now all the way down the hall in the Cabinet Room, where more than one image of George Washington could watch the proceedings. The Cabinet secretaries arrived almost together, and their arrival couldn't be a secret. Too many official cars, too many guards, too many faces known to the reporters. Pat Martin came, representing Justice. Brentano was sec-def, with Admiral Jackson sitting on the wall behind him. Everyone brought a deputy of some sort, mainly to take notes. Winston was sec-trez, having walked from across the street. Commerce and Interior were survivors from the Durling presidency, actually having been appointed by Bob Fowler. Most of the rest were of undersecretary rank, holding on from presidential apathy in some cases, and in others because they appeared to know what they were doing. But none of them knew what he was doing now. Ed Foley arrived, summoned by the president despite CIA's previous loss of cabinet rank. Also present were Ernie Van Damme, Ben Goodley, Director Murray, the First Lady, 3 Army officers, and Dr. Alexander.
"We will be in order," the President said.
"Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. There's no time for a preamble here. We face a national emergency. The decisions we make here today will have serious effects on our country. In the corner is Major General John Pickett. He's a physician and scientist, and I will now turn the meeting over to him. General, do your brief."
"Thank you, Mr. President. Ladies and gentlemen, I am Commanding General at Fort Detrick. Earlier today, we started getting some very disturbing reports."
Ryan tuned the general out. He'd heard it all twice now. Instead, he read over the file Pickett had handed him. The folder was bordered in the usual red and white striped tape. The sticker in the center read, "Top Secret, Affliction." Rather an appropriate code name for the special access compartment this one was in, Swordsman thought.
Then he opened the folder and started reading Op Plan Curtain Call. There were four variants of the plan, Jack saw. He turned to Option 4. That was called Solitary, and that name, too, was appropriate. Reading through the executive summary chilled him, and Jack found himself turning to look over at George, hanging there on the wall, and wanting to ask, "Now what the hell do I do?" But George wouldn't have understood. He didn't know from airliners and viruses and nuclear weapons, did he? "How bad is it now?" HHS asked. "Just over 200 cases have been reported to CDC as of 15 minutes ago. I emphasize that these have all appeared in less than 24 hours," General Pickett told the secretary. "Who did it?" Agriculture asked. "Set that aside," the president said. "We will address that issue later. What we have to decide now is the best chance we have to contain the epidemic." "I just can't believe that we can't treat..." "Believe it," Kathy Ryan said. "You know how many viral diseases we know how to cure?" "Well, no," Hud admitted. "None." It constantly amazed her how ignorant some people could be on medical issues. "Therefore, containment is the only option," General Pickett went on. "How do you contain a whole country?" It was Cliff Rutledge, Assistant Secretary of State for Policy, sitting in for Scott Adler. "That's the problem we face," President Ryan said. "Thank you, General. I'll take it from here. The only way to contain the epidemic is to shut down all places of assembly, theaters, shopping malls, sports stadia, business offices, everything, and also to shut off all interstate travel. To the best of our information, at least 30 states are so far untouched by this disease. We would do well to keep it that way." "We can accomplish that by preventing all interstate travel until such time as we have a handle on the severity of the disease organism we are facing, and then we can come up with less severe countermeasures." "Mr. President, that's unconstitutional," Pat Martin said at once. "Explain," Ryan ordered. "Travel is a constitutionally protected right. Even inside states, any restriction of travel is a constitutional violation under the Lemuel Penn case. He was a black army officer who was murdered by the Klan in the 60s. That's a Supreme Court precedent," the head of the criminal division reported. "I understand that just about everybody in the room, was sworn to uphold the Constitution. But if upholding it means killing off a few million citizens, what have we accomplished?" POTUS asked. "We can't do that," Hud insisted. "General, what happens if we don't?" Martin asked, surprising Ryan. "There is no precise answer. There cannot be, because we do not know the ease of transmission for this virus yet. If it is an aerosol, and there is reason to suspect that it is, well, we've got 100 computer models we can use. Problem is deciding which one. Worst case, 20 million deaths. At that point, what happens is that society breaks down. Doctors and nurses flee the hospitals, people lock themselves in their homes, and the epidemic burns out pretty much like the Black Death did in the 14th century. Human interactions cease, and because of that, the disease stops spreading." 20 million? How bad was the Black Death?" Martin asked, his face somewhat ashen. "Records are sketchy. There was no real census system back then. Best data is England," Pickett replied. "It depopulated that country by half. The plague lasted about 4 years. Europe took about 150 years to return to the 1347 population level." "Shit," breathed Interior. "Is it really that dangerous, General?" Martin persisted. "Potentially, yes. The problem, sir, is that if you take no action at all, and then you find out that it is that virulent, then it's just too late." "I see." Martin turned. "Mr. President, I do not see that we have much of a choice here."
"You just said it was against the law, dammit," Hud shouted.
"Mr. Secretary, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And although I think I know how the Supreme Court would rule on this, there has never been a case in point, and it could be argued, and the process would have to deal with it." "What changed your mind, Pat?" Ryan asked.
20 million reasons, Mr. President."
"If we flout our own laws, then what are we?" Cliff Rutledge asked.
"Alive," Martin answered quietly. "Maybe."
"I am willing to listen to arguments for 15 minutes, Ryan said.
Then we have to come to a decision.
It was lively.
If we violate our own constitution, Rutledge said, then nobody in the world can trust us.
HUD and HHS agreed.
What about the practical considerations? Agriculture objected. People have to eat.
What kind of country are we going to turn over to our children if we...
What do we turn over to them if they're dead? George Winston snapped back at HUD.
Things like this don't happen today.
Mr. Secretary, would you like to come up to my hospital and see, sir? Alexander asked from his seat in the corner.
Thank you, Ryan said, checking his watch. I am calling the issue on the table.
Defense, Treasury, Justice, and Commerce voted aye. All the rest voted no. Ryan looked at them for a long few seconds.
The ayes have it, the President said coldly. Thank you for your support. Director Murray, the FBI will render all assistance required by CDC and USAMRID to ascertain the focal centers of this epidemic. That has absolute and unconditional priority over any other matter.
Yes, Mr. President.
Mr. Foley, every intelligence asset we have goes into this. You will also work in conjunction with the medical experts. This came from somewhere, and whoever did it has committed an act of war, using weapons of mass destruction against our country. We need to find out who that was, Ed.
All the intelligence agencies will report directly to you. You have statutory authority to coordinate all intelligence activities. Tell the other agencies that you have my order to exercise it.
We'll do our best, sir.
Secretary Brentano, I am declaring a state of national emergency. All reserve and National Guard formations are to be activated immediately and placed under federal command.
You have this contingency plan in the Pentagon.
Ryan held the curtain call folder up. You will execute Option 4, solitary, at the earliest possible moment.
I will do that, sir.
Ryan looked down the table at the Secretary of Transportation.
Mr. Secretary, the air traffic control system belongs to you. When you get back to your office, you will order all aircraft in flight to proceed to their destinations and stop there. All aircraft on the ground will remain there, commencing at 6 o'clock this evening.
No,
Sec-Tran stood.
Mr. President, I will not do that. I believe it to be an illegal act and I will not break the law.
Very well, sir, I will accept your resignation effective immediately.
You're the deputy, Ryan said to the woman sitting behind him.
Yes, Mr. President, I am.
Will you execute my order?
She looked around the room without really knowing what to do. She'd heard it all, but she was a career civil servant, unaccustomed to making a hard call without political coverage.
I don't like it either, Ryan said.
The room was invaded by the roar of jet engines, an aircraft taking off from Washington National.
What if that airplane's carrying death somewhere?
Do we just let it happen? He asked so quietly she could barely hear.
I will carry out your order, sir.
You know, Murray, the former, he wasn't sure yet, Sec-Tran said, you could arrest the man right now. He's breaking the law.
Not today, sir, Murray replied, staring at his president.
Somebody's going to have to decide what the law is first.
If anyone else in the room feels the need to leave federal service over this issue, I will accept your resignations without prejudice. But please think what you are doing.
If I'm wrong on this, fine, I'm wrong, and I'll pay the price for that. But if the doctors are right and we do nothing, we've got more blood on our hands than Hitler ever did. I need your help and your support.
Ryan stood and walked out of the room as the others struggled to their feet. He moved fast. He had to. He entered the Oval Office, turned right to the presidential sitting room, and barely made it to the bathroom in time. Seconds later, Kathy found him there, flushing down a bowl full of vomit.
"Am I doing the right thing?" he asked, still on his knees.
"You've got my vote, Jack," Surgeon told him.
"You look great," Van Damme observed, catching POTUS in rather an undignified posture.
"Why didn't you say anything, Arnie?"
"Because you didn't need me to, Mr. President," the Chief of Staff replied.
General Pickett and the other physicians were waiting when he came back into the office.
"Sir, we just had a fax from CDC. There are two cases at Fort Stewart. That's the 24th MEX home base."
Chapter 50 Special Report. It started with National Guard armories. Virtually every city and town in America had one, and in each was a duty sergeant, or perhaps an officer, sitting at a desk to answer the phone. When the phone rang, a voice from the Pentagon spoke a code word that designated an activation order. The duty person in the armory would then alert the unit commander, and more calls were made, branching out like the limbs of a tree, with every recipient detailed to call several others. It usually took an hour or so for everyone to get the word, or nearly everyone, as some were inevitably out of town, traveling for either work or vacation. Senior guard commanders usually worked directly for the governors of the several states, as the National Guard is a hybrid institution, partly a state militia, and partly United States Army, or Air Force in the case of the Air National Guard, which gave many of the state governors access to state-of-the-art fighter aircraft. These senior guard officers, surprised by the activation orders, reported the situation to their governors, asking for guidance, which the state executives were as yet in no position to give, since mainly they didn't know what was going on yet either. But at the company and battalion level, officers and men and women hurried home from their civilian jobs, citizen soldiers that they were, donned their woodland pattern BDU fatigues, buffed their boots, and drove to the local armory to form up with their squads and platoons. Once there, they were startled to see that they were supposed to draw weapons and, more disturbingly, their MOP gear. MOP, for Mission-Oriented Protective Posture, was the chemical warfare equipment in which they had all trained at one time or another, and which every person in uniform cordially detested. There were the usual jokes and good humor, stories of work, tales of spouses and children, while the officers and senior non-coms met in conference rooms to find out what the hell was going on. They emerged from those brief meetings angry, confused, and, for the better informed of them, frightened. Outside the armories, vehicles were fired up. Inside, TV sets were switched on. In Atlanta, the special agent in charge of the FBI's Atlanta Field Division drove with sirens screaming to CDC, followed by 10 more agents. In Washington, a number of CIA and other intelligence officers drove more sedately to the Hoover Building to set up a joint task force. In both cases, the job was to figure out how the epidemic had started, and from that to try to determine its point of origin. These people were not all civilians. The Defense Intelligence Agency and National Security Agency were mainly uniformed organizations, and among that grouping, grim-faced officers let everyone know that something new in American history had taken place. If this truly were a deliberate attack against the United States of America, then a nation-state had made use of what was delicately termed a weapon of mass destruction. Then they explained to their civilian counterparts what had been U.S. policy for two generations for responding to such an eventuality. It was all happening too fast, of course, since emergencies are, by definition, things for which one cannot plan terribly well. That extended to the president himself, who walked into the White House press room accompanied by General Pickett of USAMRID. Only 30 minutes earlier, the White House had told the major networks that the president had an announcement to make, and that on this occasion, the government would exercise its option to demand airtime instead of requesting it. Since the 1920s, the government had adopted the position that it owned the airwaves, thus supplanting all the talk shows and other programming which preceded the evening news. Lead-in commentary told viewers that nobody knew what this was about, but that there had been an emergency cabinet meeting only minutes before. "My fellow Americans," President Ryan began, his face in most American homes, and his voice in every car on the road. Those who had become accustomed to their new president took note of the pale face. Mrs. Abbott hadn't had time to do his makeup, and grim voice. The message was grimmer still. The cement truck had a radio, of course. It even had a tape and CD player, since, work vehicle or not,
It had been designed for the use of an American citizen. They were in Indiana now, having crossed both the Mississippi River and Illinois earlier in the day on their trek to their nation's capital. Holbrook, who had no use for the words of any president, hit the scan button, only to find that the same voice was on all the stations. That was sufficiently unusual that he stayed with one of them. Brown, driving the truck, saw that cars and trucks were pulling over. Not many at first, but more and more as the speech progressed, their drivers, like himself, leaning down to listen to the radio. Accordingly, by executive order of the President, your government is taking the following actions. 1. Until further notice, all schools and colleges in the country will be closed. 2. All businesses except for those providing essential services, the media, health care, food, law enforcement, and fire protection, will also be closed until further notice. 3. All places of public assembly, theaters, restaurants, bars, and the like, will be closed. 4. All interstate travel is suspended until further notice. This means all commercial air travel, interstate trains and buses, and private passenger automobiles. Trucks carrying foodstuffs will be allowed to travel under military escort. The same is true of essential supplies, pharmaceuticals, and the like. 5. I have activated the National Guard in all the 50 states and placed it under federal control to maintain public order. A state of martial law is now enforced throughout the country. We urge our citizens... No, let me speak more informally. Ladies and gentlemen, all that is required for us to weather this crisis is a little common sense. We do not yet know how dangerous this disease is. The measures I have ordered today are precautionary in nature. They seem, and indeed they are, extreme measures. The reason for that, as I have told you, is that this virus is potentially the most deadly organism on the planet. But we do not yet know how dangerous it is. We do know that a few simple measures can limit its spread, no matter how deadly it is. And in the interest of public safety, I have ordered those measures. This action is being taken on the best scientific advice available. To protect yourselves, remember how the disease is spread. I have General John Pickett, a senior Army physician and an expert in the field of infectious diseases, to provide medical advice to all of us. General? Ryan stepped away from the microphone.
What the fuck? Holbrook shouted. He can't do that!
Think so? Brown followed an 18-wheeler onto the shoulder. They were 100 miles from the Indiana-Ohio border. About 2 hours driving this pig, he thought. No way he'd get there before the local guard closed the road. I think we better find a motel, Pete. So what do I do? The FBI agent asked in Chicago. Strip. Hang your clothes on the door. There was no time and little spare room for the niceties, and he was, after all, a physician. His guest didn't blush. Dr. Klein decided on full surgical garb, long-sleeve greens instead of the more popular sort. There were not enough of the plastic spacesuits to go around, and his staff would use all of those. They had to. They got closer. They handled liquids. They touched the patients. His medical center now had 9 symptomatic patients who tested positive. 6 of those were married, and of the spouses, 4 tested positive for Ebola antibodies. The test gave an occasional false positive reading. Even so, it was not the least bit pleasant to tell someone. Well, he did that often enough with AIDS patients. They were testing children now. That really hurt. The protective outfit he gave the agent was made of the usual cotton, but the hospital had taken a number of sets and sprayed them with disinfectant, especially the masks. The agent also was given a pair of laboratory glasses,
the broad plastic ones known to chemistry students. "Okay," Klein told the agent, "don't get close. No closer than 6 feet, and you should be completely safe. If she vomits or coughs, if she has a convulsion, stay clear."
"Dealing with that sort of thing is our job, not yours. Even if she dies right in front of you, don't touch anything."
"I understand. You going to lock the office up?"
She pointed to the gun hanging with her clothes.
"Yes, I will. And when you're done, give me your notes. I'll run them through the copying machine."
"How come?"
"It uses a very bright light to make copies. The ultraviolet will almost certainly kill any virus particle that might find its way to the paper," Professor Klein explained. Even now in Atlanta, rapid experiments were underway to determine just how robust the Ebola particles were. That would help define the level of precaution that was necessary in hospitals, first of all, and perhaps also provide useful guidance for the general population.
Doc, why not just let me make the copies?"
"Oh." Klein shook his head. "Yes, I suppose that will work too, won't it?"
"Mr. President," it was Barry of CNN, "these steps you're taking, sir, are they legal?"
"Barry, I do not have the answer to that," Ryan said, his face tired and drawn. "Whether they're legal or not, I am convinced that they are necessary." As he spoke, a White House staffer was passing out surgical masks for the assembled reporters. That was Ernie's idea. They'd been procured from the nearby George Washington University Hospital.
"But, Mr. President, you can't break the law. What if you're wrong?"
"Barry, there's a fundamental difference between what I do in my job and what you do in yours. If you make a mistake, you can make a retraction. We just saw that only yesterday with one of your colleagues, didn't we? But, Barry, if I make a mistake in a situation like this, how do I retract a death? How do I retract thousands of deaths?"
"I don't have that luxury, Barry," the president said.
"If it turns out that what I am doing is wrong, then you can have at me all you want. That's part of my job, too, and I'm getting used to that. Maybe I'm a coward. Maybe I'm just afraid of letting people die for no good reason when I have the power to prevent it."
"But you don't really know, do you?"
"No," Jack admitted, "none of us really knows. This is one of those times when you have to go with your best guess. I wish I could sound more confident, but I can't, and I won't lie about it."
"Who did it, Mr. President?" another reporter asked.
"We don't know, and for the moment I will not speculate as to the origin of this epidemic." And that was a lie, Ryan knew, even as he was saying it, speaking the lie right after stating that he wouldn't lie, because the situation demanded that, too. What a crazy fucking world it was. It was the worst interview of her life. The woman she saw, called the Index case, was attractive, or had been so a day or two previously. Now skin that had so recently qualified as a peaches-and-cream complexion was sallow and mottled with red-purple blotches. Worst of all, she knew. She had to know, the agent thought, hiding behind her mask, holding her felt-tip pen in the rubber gloves, nothing sharp that might penetrate the thin latex, taking her notes, and learning not very much. She had to know that this sort of medical care was not the usual thing, that the medics were afraid to touch her, and that now a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation would not even approach her bed.
Aside from the trip to Kansas City?
"Nothing, really," the voice replied, as though from the bottom of a grave. "Working at my desk, getting ready for the fall orders. Went to the housewares show at McCormick Center 2 days."
There were some more questions, none of which turned up any immediately useful information. The woman in the agent wanted to reach out, touch her hand, provide some measure of comfort and sympathy. But no.
The agent had just learned the previous week that she was pregnant with her first child. She had custody of two lives now, not just her own, and it was all she could do to keep her hand from shaking. "Thank you. We'll be back to you," the agent said, rising from her metal chair and moving to the door. Opening it, she pulled her shoulders in so as not to touch the door frame, and proceeded to the next room down the hall for the next interview. Klein was in the corridor discussing something with another staffer. Doc or nurse, the agent couldn't tell. "How'd it go?" the professor asked. "What are her chances?" the agent asked. "Essentially zero," Mark Klein replied. For diseases like this one, patient zero was just that.
"Compensation? They ask us for compensation?" the defense minister demanded before the foreign minister could speak.
"Minister, I merely convey the words of others," Adler reminded his hosts.
"We have had two officers from your Air Force examine the missile fragments. Their judgment confirms our own. It is a Penlong 13, their new heat seeker with the long range, a development of a Russian weapon. It's definite now, in addition to the radar evidence developed from your ships," defense added. "The shooting of the airliner was a deliberate act. You know that. So do we. So tell me, Mr. Adler, where does America stand in this dispute?"
"We wish nothing more than the restoration of peace," Sexstate replied, confirming his own predictions. "I would also point out that the PRC, in allowing my direct flights between their capital and yours, are showing a measure of goodwill."
"Quite so," the foreign minister replied. "Or so it might seem to the casual observer. But tell me, Mr. Adler, what do they really want?"
So much, the American Secretary of State told himself, for settling the situation down. These two were as smart as he was, and even more angry. Then that changed. A secretary knocked, then entered, annoying his boss until they exchanged a few words in Mandarin. A telex was passed over and read. Then another was given directly to the American.
"It seems that there is a serious problem in your country, Mr. Secretary."
The press conference was cut off. Ryan left the room, returned to the Oval Office, and sat on the couch with his wife.
"How did it go?"
"Didn't you watch?" Jack asked.
"We were talking over some things," Kathy explained.
Then Arnie came in.
"Not bad, boss," the chief of staff opined. "You will have to meet with people from the Senate this evening. I just worked that out with the leadership on both sides. This will make the elections today a little interesting, and—" "Arnie, until further notice, we will not discuss politics in this building. Politics is about ideology and theory. We have to deal with cold facts now," Swordsman said.
"You can't get away from it, Jack. Politics is real. And if this is the deliberate attack the general here says it is, then it's war. And war is a political act. You're leading the government. You have to lead the Congress, and that is a political act. You're not a philosopher, King. You're the president of a democratic country," Van Damme reminded him.
"All right." Ryan sighed his surrender to the moment.
"What else?"
"Brentano called. The plan is being implemented right now. In a few minutes, the air traffic system tells all the airliners to stop flying. There's probably a lot of chaos in the airports right now."
"I bet." Jack closed his eyes and rubbed them.
"Sir, you don't have that much choice in the matter," General Pickett told the president.
"How do I get back to Hopkins?" Alexander asked. "I have a department to run and patients to treat."
"I told Brentano that people will be allowed to leave Washington," Van Damme informed the others in the room. "The same will be true of all big cities with borders nearby. New York, Philadelphia, and like that. We have to let people go home, right?"
Pickett nodded.
"Yes, they're safer there. It's unrealistic to assume that the plan will be properly implemented until midnight or so."
Then Kathy spoke.
Alex, I guess you'll come with me. I have to fly up, too.
What?
Ryan's eyes opened.
Jack, I'm a doctor, remember?
You're an eye doctor, Kathy. People can wait to get new glasses, Jack insisted.
At the staff meeting today, we agreed that everybody has to pitch in. We can't just leave it to the nurses and the kids, the residents, to treat these patients. I'm a clinician. We all have to take our turn on this, honey, Surgeon told her husband.
No. No, Kathy, it's too dangerous.
Jack turned to face her.
I won't let you.
Jack, all those times you went away, the things you never told me about, the dangerous things.
You were doing your job, she said reasonably.
I'm a doctor. I have a job, too.
It's not all that dangerous, Mr. President, Alexander put in. You just have to follow the procedures. I work with AIDS patients every day and... No, goddammit!
Because I'm a girl, Carolyn Ryan asked gently. It worries me some, too, Jack. But I'm a professor at a medical school. I teach students how to be doctors. I teach them what their professional responsibilities are. One of those responsibilities is to be there for your patients.
You can't run away from your duties.
I can't either, Jack.
I'd like to see the procedures you've set up, Alex, Pickett said.
Glad to have you, John.
Jack continued to look in his wife's face. He knew she was strong, and he'd always known that she sometimes treated patients with contagious diseases. AIDS produced some serious eye complications. He'd just never thought much about it. Now he had to.
What if...
It won't.
I have to be careful. I think you did it to me again.
She kissed him in front of the others.
My husband has the most remarkable timing, she told the audience.
It was too much for Ryan. His hand started to shake a little and his eyes teared up. He blinked them away.
Please, Kathy. Would you have listened to me on the way to that submarine, Jack?
She kissed him again and stood. There was resistance, but not all that much. Four governors told their adjutant generals, the usual title for a state's senior National Guard officer, not to obey the presidential order. And three of those wavered until the Secretary of Defense called to make the order clear and personal, threatening them with immediate relief, arrest, and court-martial. Some talked about organizing protests, but that took time, and the green vehicles were already starting to move, their orders modified in many cases, like the Philadelphia Cavalry, one of the Army's most ancient and revered units, whose members had escorted George Washington to his inauguration more than 2 centuries earlier, and whose current troopers now headed for the bridges on the Delaware River. Local TV and radio told people that commuters would be allowed to go home without inhibitions until 9 that night, and until midnight with identification check. If it was easy, people would be allowed to get home. That happened in most cases, but not all, and motels filled up all across America. Children, told that schools would be closed for at least a week, greeted the news with enthusiasm, puzzled at the concern and even outright fear their parents displayed. Pharmacies, which sold things like surgical masks, ran out of them in a matter of minutes, their clerks mainly not knowing why, until someone switched on a radio. In Pittsburgh, strangely, the Secret Service agents going over security arrangements for President Ryan's coming visit were late getting the word, while most on the advance team hustled into the bar to watch the president on TV, Raymond broke away to make a phone call. He called his home, waited for the four rings until his answering machine kicked in, then punched the code to access the messages. It was a false one, as before, announcing the arrival of a rug he hadn't ordered and a price he would not have to pay. Raymond experienced a slight chill. He was now free to complete his mission at his discretion. That meant soon, as it was expected that he would die in the effort. This he was willing to do, though he thought he might have a chance now,
as he walked to the bar. The other three agents stood right by the TV. When someone objected to their blockage of his view, a set of credentials were held up. "Holy shit," the senior man from the Pittsburgh office said for the rest. "Now what do we do?" It was tricky with international flights. The word was only now getting to the embassies in Washington. They communicated the nature of the emergency to their governments, but for the European ones, senior officials were at home, many getting into bed when the calls came. These had to get into their offices, have their own meetings, and decide what to do. But the long duration of overwater flights mainly gave time for that. Soon it was decided that all passengers on flights from America would be quarantined. How long? They didn't know yet. Urgent calls to the American Federal Aviation Administration made arrangements to allow flights to America to sit on the ground, be refueled, and then depart for their points of origin. These aircraft were identified as uncontaminated, their passengers allowed to proceed home, though there would be bureaucratic mistakes along the way. That the financial markets would be closed was made apparent by an Ebola case which arrived in Northwestern University Medical Center. He was a commodities trader who customarily worked on the raucous floor of the Chicago Board of Trade, and the news was quick to get out. All the exchanges would be closed, and the next worry for the business and financial community was the effect this would have on their activities. But mainly people watched the TV coverage. Every network found its medical expert and gave him or her free rein to explain the problem, usually in too much detail. Cable channels ran science specials on Ebola outbreaks in Zaire, showing just how far flu symptoms might lead. What resulted was a quiet, private sort of panic throughout the nation. People in their homes, inspecting their pantries to see how much food they had, watching TV and worrying as they also struggled to ignore. When neighbors talked, it was at a distance. The case count reached 500 just before 8 o'clock in Atlanta. It had been a long day for Gus Lorenz, gyrating as he did between his laboratory and his office. There was danger for him and his staff. Fatigue made for errors and accidents. Normally a sedate establishment, one of the world's finest research laboratories, the people there were accustomed to working in a calm, orderly way. Now it was frantic. Blood samples couriered to them had to be tagged and tested, and the results faxed to the hospital of origin. Lauren struggled throughout the day to reorganize his people and their functions, so as to keep staff on duty around the clock, but also not to overly fatigue anyone. He had to apply that to himself as well, and when he returned to his office to catch a nap, he found someone waiting inside. FBI, the man said, holding up his ID folder. It was actually the local SAC, a very senior agent who'd been running his own office over a cellular phone. He was a tall, quiet man, slow to excite. In crisis situations, he told his force of agents, you think first. There was always time to screw things up, and there had to be time to get them right, too. "What can I do for you?" Lawrence asked, taking his seat. "Sir, I need you to brief me in. The Bureau is working with a few other agencies to see how this all started. We're interviewing every victim to try and determine where they got sick, and we figure you're the expert to ask about the overall situation. Where did all this start?" The military didn't know where it had started, but it was rapidly becoming apparent where it had gotten to. Fort Stewart, Georgia, had only been the first. Nearly every army base was near some big city or other. Fort Stewart was within easy driving distance of Savannah and Atlanta. Fort Hood was close to Dallas-Fort Worth. Fort Campbell, an hour from Nashville, where Vanderbilt had already reported cases. The personnel lived mainly in barracks, where they shared common showers and toilet facilities.
and at these bases the senior medical officers were quite literally terrified. Naval personnel lived the most closely of all. Their ships were enclosed environments. Those ships at sea were instantly ordered to remain there while the shoreside situation was evaluated. It was soon determined that every major base was at risk. And though some units, mainly infantry and military police, deployed to augment the National Guard, medics kept an eye on every soldier and marine. Soon they started finding men and women with flu symptoms. These were instantly isolated, put in protective mop gear, and flown by helicopter to the nearest hospital that was receiving suspected Ebola cases. By midnight it would be clear that, until further notice, the U.S. military was a contaminated instrument. Urgent calls into the National Military Command Center reported which units had found cases, and on that information whole battalions were separated from others and kept that way, the personnel eating combat rations because their mess halls were closed, and thinking about an enemy they couldn't see.
"Jesus, John," Chavez said in the latter's office. Clark nodded silently. His wife, Sandy, was an instructor in nursing in a teaching hospital, and her life, he knew, might be at risk. She worked a medical floor. If an infected patient arrived, he would come to her unit, and Sandy would take the lead to show her students how to treat such patients safely.
"Safely?" he asked himself.
"Sure."
The thought brought back dark memories and the sort of fear he hadn't known in many years. This attack on his country, Clark hadn't been told yet, but he never had learned to believe in coincidences, didn't put him at risk, but it put his wife at risk.
"Who do you suppose did it?"
It was a dumb question, and it generated a dumber reply.
"Somebody who doesn't like us a whole hell of a lot," John answered crossly.
"Sorry." Chavez looked out the window and thought for a few seconds.
"It's one hell of a gamble, John."
"If we find out it is. And operational security on something like this is a motherfucker.
Rojo, Mr. C. The people we've been looking at?"
"That's a possibility."
"Others, too, I suppose."
He checked his watch. Director Foley should be back from Washington by now, and they should head up to his office. It took only a couple of minutes.
"Hi, John," the DCI said, looking up from his desk. Mary Pat was there, too.
"Not an accident, is it?" Clark asked.
"No, it's not. We're setting up a joint task force. The FBI is talking to people inside the country. If we get leads, it'll be our job to work outside the borders. You two will stand by to handle that. I'm trying to figure a way now to get people overseas."
"The SNI?" Ding asked.
"Everything else is on the back burner now. Jack even gave me authority to order NSA and DIA around." Though the DCI, by law, had the power to do just that, in fact, the other large agencies had always been their own independent empires. Until now.
"How are the kids, guys?" Clark asked.
"Home," Mary Pat replied. Queen spook or not, she was still a mother with a mother's concerns.
"They say they feel fine."
"Weapons of mass destruction," Chavez said next. He didn't have to say anything more.
"Yeah," the DCI nodded.
Somebody either had overlooked or didn't care about the fact that United States policy for years had been explicit on that issue. A nuke was a germ, was a gas shell, and the reply to a germ or a gas shell was a nuke, because America had those and didn't have the others. Foley's desk phone rang.
"Yes?"
He listened for a few seconds. "Fine, could you send a team here for that?"
"Good, thank you."
"What was that?"
"USAMRID at Fort Detrick."
"Okay, they'll be here in an hour. We can send people overseas, but they have to have their blood tested first. The European countries are, well, you can imagine. Shit, you can't take a fucking dog into England without leaving him in a kennel for a month to make sure he doesn't have rabies. You'll probably have to be tested on the other side of the pond, too. Flight crew also, the DCI added.
We're not packed, Clark said.
Buy what you need over there, John, okay? Mary Pat paused.
Sorry.
Do we have any leads to run down?
Not yet, but that will change. You can't do something like this without leaving some footprints.
Something strange here, Chavez observed, looking down the long, narrow top-floor office.
John, remember what I said the other day?
No, Clark said. What do you mean?
Some things you can't retaliate about. Some things you can't reverse. Hey, if this was a terrorist op...
Too big, Mary Pat objected. Too sophisticated.
Fine, ma'am. Even if it was. Hell, we could turn the Bekaa Valley into a parking lot and send the Marines in to paint the lines after it cools down. That ain't no secret. Same thing's true of a nation-state, isn't it? We ditched the ballistic missiles, but we still have nuclear bombs. We can burn any country down to bedrock, and President Ryan would do it. At least I wouldn't bet the house against it. I've seen the guy in action, and he ain't no panty-waste.
So, the DCI asked.
He didn't say that it wasn't that simple. Before Ryan or anyone else initiated a nuclear release order, the evidence would have to be of the sort to pass scrutiny with the Supreme Court. And he didn't think Ryan was the sort to do such a thing under most circumstances.
So whoever ran this op is thinking one of two things. Either it won't matter if we find out, or we can't respond that way, or...
There was a third one, wasn't there? It was almost there, but not quite.
Or they take the president out.
But then why try for his little girl first? Mary Pat asked.
That just increases security around him. Makes the job harder instead of easier. We have things happening all over. The Chinese thing, the UIR, the Indian Navy sneaked out to sea. All the political crap here, and now this Ebola. There's no picture. All these things are unconnected.
Except they're all making our life hard, aren't they?
The room got quiet for a few seconds.
The boy's got a point, Clark told the other two.
It always starts in Africa, Lauren said, filling his pipe. That's where it lives. There was an outbreak in Zaire a few months ago.
Didn't make the news, the FBI agent said.
Only two victims, a young boy and a nurse. Nursing none, I think, but she was lost in a plane crash. Then there was a mini-break in Sudan. Again, two victims, an adult male and a little girl. The man died, the child survived. That was weeks ago, too. We have blood samples from the index case. We've been experimenting with that one for a while now.
How do you do that?
You culture the virus in tissue. Monkey kidneys, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah, he remembered.
What's that?
I put in an order for some African greens. That's the monkey we use. You euthanize them and extract the kidneys.
Somebody got there first, and I had to wait for another order.
Do you know who it was?
Lawrence shook his head.
No, never found out.
Put me back a week, 10 days, that's all.
Who else would want the monkeys? The SAC asked.
Pharmaceutical houses? Medical labs like that?
Who would I talk to about that?
You serious?
Yes, sir.
Lauren shrugged and pulled the card off his Rolodex.
Here.
The breakfast meeting had taken a little time to arrange. Ambassador David L. Williams left his car, then was escorted into the Prime Minister's official residence. He was grateful for the time of day. India could be a furnace, and at his age the heat became increasingly oppressive. Especially since he had to dress like an ambassador, instead of a governor of Pennsylvania, where it was okay to look working class. In this country, working class meant even more informal clothing, and that made the upper crust even haughtier with their beloved symbols of status. World's largest democracy, they liked to call this place, the retired politician thought.
Sure.
The PM was already seated at the table. She rose when he entered the room, took his hand, and conveyed him to his seat.
The china was gold-trimmed, and a liveried servant came in to serve coffee. Breakfast started with melon.
Thank you for receiving